I have a question, Shell. I'm interested in hearing a little bit about the ASPO, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, and how that organization started and what the prospects for starting something like that that would be similar to that in the United States.
Well, of course, you must have someone that is a little bit more than anyone else, so to speak, and that is Colin Campbell. He's retired now, but he has been working in the oil industry all his life, and he has a lot of knowledge, and he knew how to treat data and look at data and so on. And it started in such a way that he met people that suggested that he should create some kind of net of interested people. So everyone in ASPO is independent, but we are working in the same direction. So I'm in Sweden, is working for in Sweden for things that is important, but we have the network to support that support us and gives us a name out to the rest of the world. So and then we had the first workshop that dealt with the depletion of oil in Uppsala in 2002. I mean, that's 3 years ago. At that time, I would say that no one more or less knew about ASPO. Today, we have a conference in Lisbon in May. It's a huge interest for the conference, you know, and we see already that people from all over the world is coming to this workshop, and that's just great.
That's the conference in Portugal, in Lisbon?
Yes, in May, in the middle of May. So if you listen to this and you think this is important to get knowledge about and so on, you're welcome to come to Lisbon.
And what's the membership of ASPO like? It's mainly the scientific community?
Well, we should be in some way independent. You should not have the government picking on your shoulder. And, as a professor at the university, I feel completely independent to say what I like and so on. And that's the way with most of the people, that they are free and they are allowed to say what they think is right and so on. And that's a great thing, because free thinking people is what we need.
Is the ASPO an organization that really looks at itself as a European entity?
Yes, we have said European because there are so many that suggest that we should go international, but then we need so much more money, a completely different budget, and we need so many more people that is working on staff and so on. Okay, if someone is willing to put up a couple of million of dollars, I might consider to make it international, but we don't have the money. I mean, because all of this we are doing more or less on our free time, so to speak. I mean, we are not paid for doing this. We just do it because we think we need to do it for the world.
Maybe right. This is a project for Mr. Soros.
Yes, or you have another guy called Bill Gates, you know. And so if Bill Gates call me and say we need to do something, okay, then we can do it.
So you've obviously spent a lot of time over here in the U.S. and you're a native European. Are there any things that you see that the Europeans are doing now that we could learn from and vice versa to stave off any major disruptions and problems?
There is a difference between Europe and U.S., and that is distance. I mean, the area of Europe is so much smaller than the area of United States. And that means transportation can be handled in another way. For instance, in Europe, we have trains in all countries to all major cities, you know. And going by train is something very easy in Europe. If I should go from Sweden down to Germany, train is a choice. But, I mean, if you're going in U.S. From Los Angeles to New York, train is not a choice, you know, and that's a big problem. So the infrastructure problem huge for U.S. And I don't really know how you could solve that. But that is an advantage for Europe now, that we are more compact and we can use transportation that don't need so much oil in the future.
And ironically, I believe Bush is actually cutting the Amtrak budget.
Well, I think that what you should do is to have, say, the ground transportation in regions. Let's take California as one region, for instance. As I spend a lot of time in Berkeley and San Francisco and so I know it quite well. I mean, a fast train between San Francisco and Los Angeles, you could go in a couple of hours on a train from the center of San Francisco to the center of Los Angeles. You know, you don't need the transport to the airports and all this kind. You will do it at the same time. And you can do it without using oil. But, I mean, if you should go to Chicago, okay, you should use air transportation on the long-distance transportation, but you should use other means of transportation on short distance.
So it's very similar to the choices of energy sources, and it varies according to the need.
Yes. Use the right transportation for the right distance, so to speak. And I mean, we should not ban air transport, flying, because we need to do it, but we should do it when we need it. And I mean, for instance, going from San Francisco to Los Angeles, you can do that without air transportation if you build the right tracks.
I was interested in seeing there's a group called Community Solution out in Ohio that has spent a lot of time studying Cuba's response to its artificial peak.
Yes.
And their transportation system is quite unique. They developed, I forgot the name of it, but it's a large tractor. Well, it's a tractor trailer that's fueled by diesel, but they built a large trailer.
Wagons for transportation of people, yes.
The 350 people can fit in.
But, you know, Cuba is a limited area. If you take the size of the country, it's not that huge, you know. So they can find a local solution, and they don't need to fly in that local solution in the country.
Right.
Okay, so it's possible to make a solution there. And again, as I said, if you take the New York, Washington area and so on, again, you don't need to really fly between Washington and New York if you have the right tracks.
The tracks are there, but I'm not sure the political will and the responsible media is present in this country to be able to really get this across to the public that this is what needs to happen.
Well, the thing is that oil, you know, there is so much energy stored in oil, so it's really hard to believe it, you know. And we are metric ways. I use the deciliter, but you know, one deciliter has the same amount of energy that you need to lift a car to the top of the Eiffel Tower, for instance.
Right.
And I used to say that because of the fact that energy is in those quantities are stored in oil, we are addicted to oil. And you know, when you are addicted to something, you are willing to do whatever you need to get your drug. And the world is entering into that situation now. So if we don't have that protocol I talked about, I think that we will, in the future, see a fight over the oil between U.S. and China.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Maybe we here in America, we need some sort of a 12-step program for our dependency on oil.
It's not you. I mean, this is something that concerns the whole world, you know. So I used to say to people here in Europe that we should not just blame United States because we are in the same situation ourselves.
Well, we appreciate that, Shell.
We are exporting 100%, importing 100% of the oil that we need, you know.
Right.
And you are only importing 60%.
Right.
So Europe in general, I think, is something like 80 to 90% they are importing. So we are all in the same situation, and we should all work together on this. You know, it's not just to blame U.S. for everything here, but on the other hand, U.S. must realize that there is a problem because they need to do that, and I think that Congress should really have a hearing of the guys in the Energy Information Administration, because they should respond to Congress and not to the Department of Energy, because they are appointed by them. They are in principle appointed by the people, and they should be responsible to the people.
I don't know if you if you pay that much attention to there's a media outlet called C-SPAN that sort of covers Congress, and they film them, and that you can get on the web and watch hearings. And actually, the other day, two representatives from Maryland, which is a state in the East Coast, Republicans actually presented the whole scenario of peak oil quite eloquently.
I saw it on the web.
Oh, you did. Roscoe Bartlett.
The thing that was surprising for me was that there was more or less no one there listening to it.
Nobody there. that happens.
So, I mean, okay, that's
that actually
great,
happens.
But if no one is there, what good does it mean?
Often that happens in Congress. They'll just go ahead and present at an off time for the media, and then they're going to have another hearing on this. And actually, if people listening could encourage Bernie Sanders to go to that's our representative, to actually go to this hearing. I think it's on April 14th. Roscoe Bartlett, Republican representative from Maryland. We need to encourage our representatives to actually go to this hearing and start becoming
but
aware.
I have to say, a hearing is much more efficient.
Yeah, I think the empty chamber is more of a result of our political finance system, because they're going to be out raising money so much they can't really spend their time in Washington. Shell, in the last few minutes you're here with us, would you like to take a couple callers?
Okay, yes, fine, I do that.
All right, thanks. Caller, are you on the air?
I am. Good afternoon. I heard Shell make a comment a couple of maybe 3-4 minutes ago about our being addicted to energy, and I would like to point out that I don't think it's energy we're addicted to. I think it's stupidity. Just as a few examples, I don't know how it is. Is it Sweden that you're from, Shell?
Yes, I'm from Sweden, yes.
Yeah. I don't know how much time you spend in the United States and how much you've observed the way we do things over here, but what we do is we carve up some of our best farmland and put tacky little houses all over it so that everybody can drive from there to a place to work in their separate automobile,
yes,
have their separate lawnmower that burns gasoline, have their separate ATV, SUV, their separate snowmobile, and all of these things suck up gargantuan amounts of energy. And a lot of these houses that go into these developments are made to look stylish or to appeal to a certain mindset. They're not designed really to be energy efficient.
Oh, that's right.
And I've long said that anybody who really wanted to make the reason that this continues on at such a rampant pace and it isn't turning around and will continue to do that is we don't make it stylish to do anything else. If we continue to make it stylish to live with great amounts of ostentation and make it look stupid and backwards and tree-hugging to live a simpler, less energy-intensive lifestyle, it's going to be very hard to turn it around.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But if we were, for example, to go into right into the centers of our cities and create some really stylish and opulent places for people to live. I don't say that they have to be, you know, little dirt floor cabins in the woods. I mean, they can be quite luxurious as long as they're energy efficient. And make these zones quiet places. Keep the traffic out of them. You know, you can drive about so close, you have to have, you know, or you can ride the train or the subway or whatever about so close, and you have to walk the rest of the way. and make these places attractive to live, people will want to live in the cities.
Yes.
And if they live in the cities, they won't have lawns to mow, and they won't have great distances to commute in their automobiles anymore. And the amount of energy that the American population uses will be dramatically decreased. Not to mention connecting those cities with mass transit instead of superhighways.
I think will come in the future. And I can mention for you, for instance, it kind of surprised me here in Stockholm that there is a big fraction of the young generation that don't care about to take a driver's license because they are using public transportation and they like to live in the city and they think they don't need a car. That cannot be true for everyone, but it should be a possibility for some people that like to do it.
Right.
We are creating that we are what's calling walking society, and I think that could probably be very profitable for some guy that are making house constructions to do something like that.
Yeah. But
and there's another thing also that is kind of surprised me as I spent several years in U.S., and that is if you live in an area with rather warm weather, then you, for some reason, don't think you need to have insulation in your house. But the problem is that it's more energy, it takes more energy to cool 2 degrees than to warm 2 degrees.
Yes.
So, in principle, the houses that need most insulation in United States are the one in Arizona, in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely counterintuitive.
But those are things that is very important. So, you can live in Tucson, Arizona, but then you need very heavy insulation on your house, so you don't need so much energy to cool it down.
When you were talking about the fact that the young people over there don't see the need for a driver's license, it's kind of interesting that I can put in a plug for my home state. I went to school in Morgantown, West Virginia, and it's very interesting. There they have a small metro system for the campus of West Virginia University, and I know at the time I went to school there, you really didn't need a vehicle. I didn't have a vehicle for several years when I went to school there because it, even though it was a spread-out campus and actually had two separate campuses with the it was called the personal rapid transit system. Cars were unnecessary, which was a good thing because parking was very limited.
Was that available to the public or just the students?
I can tell you that here at in Uppsala, it's a university town, something like 30,000 students. And I don't think that those 30,000 students has 1,000 cars even. And what they are using is bicycles. They go by bicycle to class and from the student accommodations and so on, and everyone is bicycling.
It was available to both. The students got a free pass, but the general public could ride it, and it was nearly free. It was something like a quarter or something a ride, so it was nothing. But yeah, it really helped because, like, Morgantown's very kind of hilly and has very little parking, and so it made cars unnecessary.
May I make another little comment, and then I'll hang up so someone else can call in?
Sure.
just kind of to conclude what I was saying in response to Shell's comment about our addiction to energy, I really feel strongly that if we can get to a point where we can make it stylish to live in an energy-conservative way, and if we can get to a point where we can appeal to people's competitive nature, and we don't have any problem with a competitive nature selling to them bigger SUVs and selling them more and more. If we can just get to people's competitive nature to say, ooh, I get so much fuel mileage with my vehicle. Oh, I use so little fuel because I use mass transit or whatever. If you can just get people to feel competitive about that, I swear to God, this problem will disappear overnight. But
that is something for Hollywood, you know. They should create a theory for the TV that makes it stylish to live on less.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
I mean, if you have a program on TV that everyone looks at week after week, and the theme for the program should be that it's stylish to live on less, you know.
Yes.
You need to do something like that. So Hollywood has a big response in this.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing the interview, Kevin, and thanks for talking to us, Shell.
Thank you for the call.
Take care.
I've got one other. A caller called in with a quick question that I didn't get in earlier when it was probably more appropriate, but I just wanted to get it in since they did call in. They asked if you could kind of spell out the spectrum of options for useful biofuel alternatives as to which ones are the most feasible and which ones kind of are a little bit more niche-oriented.
Well, biofuel, to use that for heating is perfect, and you should do that. If you take other renewable sources, the problem often is that you need energy at a specific time. So if you take sun energy, for instance, okay, the sun is shining during the day, but not in the night, and normally you need electricity during the night more than during the day. So that's a problem, because there is no way whatsoever to store electricity. So you need to work on storage system. And wind energy is a little bit better, but still you have a problem that it might be that it's not blowing the day when you need the electricity. But again, you can have a wind energy as some kind of base load for things, but you need to then to have other things to do the adjustment to get the energy when you need it. So it's again, as I said before, you have to think what you need and when you need it, and then make the choice.
I think Lee has a final comment.
I'd just like to thank you, Shell, for all the work you've done in the ASPO. And if people want to check out the ASPO website, it's peakoil.net. There's a lot of great resources that it looks like that Lisbon conference might be a great thing to go to. Thank you so much.
I think this will be something special. And the more people that understand the reality, the more people can tell to their friends that we need to do something. The word has I think has to be spread mouth to mouth. But, you know, you can do it quite easily and quite fast. If you have 10 friends and you tell them, okay, we need to do that, and they have 10 friends and tell them we need to do that, in just a week or two, we can have spread it to a big fraction of the population.
Well, you're certainly doing that on a global level, and I hope we're starting something here on a local level. And thanks for standing in for the entire show and filling in for some cancellations.
I like to talk about these things, and of course I had to apologize for the fact that my English is not fluent. I think it's better to speak not perfectly than to be quiet.
We didn't notice.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much again. And that was Shell. You want to give for last name, because I've boggled it every time.
Aleklett.
Aleklett from Uppsala University in Sweden and the president for the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Thank you very much. And that's the end of this portion of the program. We're actually going to air a speech by Colin Campbell, who was mentioned earlier in the show.
It's actually an interview with Colin Campbell by Julian Darley. And Colin Campbell, as Shell said, is one of the main driving forces behind the ASPO. I think this is an interview that happened at the 2004 conference.
All righty. Thank you.
This is Julian Darley for Global Public Media in Berlin on May the 27th, 2004, interviewing Dr. Colin Campbell after the annual ASPO workshop. What are your impressions of ASPO 2004, and what is the Rimini Protocol?
Well, I think it was a successful conference in two main regards. First, almost 300 people came to it from all over the world. A wide spectrum of different kinds of people. And secondly, it had enormous media coverage. There were a lot of journalists, a lot of TV people, which told me that the peak oil story was really becoming of prime interest to everybody. As far as the content of the conference was concerned, I think one could say that it was deliberate. The organizers of it wanted to give emphasis to gas, which they did, and to the wider energy issues of Germany in particular, and also to renewable energies. So in a sense, it lost the prime message of peak oil. But that said, there was some quite lively debate. There was a moment when Fatih Birol from the International Energy Agency made his presentation, which seemed to be based on really, it's hard to exactly explain what I mean, but I came to conclude that there were four different sort of camps in this business. There were, one could almost picture it as a medieval field of battle with different camps in different corners of this battlefield, and I like to say that in one camp are the surveyors. These people have the mission of defining, describing, identifying, and above all measuring something. That is their job, and really it's a very simple role. And then you have the economic fundamentalists, you could call them, who have this really outdated economic principles inherited from the Industrial Revolution, when the world was indeed large and man could the scope for man's activities were at that time more or less infinite. And so we're basically living in the past with these economic principles, which are very short term in their nature, and so on. And so I think these people who say that there can be no shortage in an open market, and their battle cry is liberalized markets. So these people have become really the enemy, one has to say. And then there's another interesting faction, and I've rather changed my position on these people. You have institutions like the International Energy Agency, and there was a member from the European Parliament there who explained this rather well. And these people, I thought they were intensely stupid in earlier years. You know, I thought, is it possible that a responsible organization of that kind could be quite so misguided and quite so far from the reality of things? But on second thoughts, I realized that they are deliberately trying to mislead people as much as possible. And perhaps that's a very good thing that they do, because the reality is such a monumental effect. I mean, the stock market crashes, the currencies go to hell, probably the whole government system is put in threat if the true position were to be revealed. So I call these people the pretenders. They understand it fairly well, perhaps, but they have to pretend it's something different. And one hopes that behind the scenes, it isn't all pretense. That's for public consumption, and one hopes that in reality somewhere somebody is making some sensible plans. At the moment, this is largely in the realm of hope, but to give them the benefit of the doubt, one could say that's what they're doing. So I had a little bit of a conflict with this Fatih Birol, who apparently took a bit of offense at this interpretation of his role. And then lastly, you have people I call the renegades. And these are senior politicians who are now out of office and being freed from the system are able to tell the truth, and some of them do. And in the audience at this meeting was Yves Cochet, the former Minister of the Environment of France, who has excellent ideas and really understands things very well and is quite forthright in what he says. So I identified these four different groups. And then I think, as far as my own contribution to this thing was concerned, I did come forth with a proposal, the so-called Rimini Protocol. And the origin of this is a conference in Rimini last year. And the city of Rimini has now agreed in principle to host a conference next year of world leaders, and I prepared in fact a booklet on this whole subject to be translated and sent to world leaders. And the proposal is that the producing countries would not produce in excess of their present depletion rate, that being annual production as a percentage of what is left, and in fact few of them can do so anyway, so there's no particular difficulty in them agreeing to such a thing. But more important than that, is that the importers would cut their imports to the same level, and this would have the effect of keeping world prices in reasonable relationship to actual production cost, would allow the third world countries, the poor countries, to afford at least something. It would stop the Middle East or whoever controls it from profiteering from shortage. And one has to say, in earlier years, profiteering was considered to be somewhat immoral. So there's a morality issue enters itself there. But more important than those general things is the result that would mean that the consumers, the importing countries, would have to learn to avoid waste. And all I'm saying is, if you look out of the window, you see 100 cars go by in 10 minutes. I'm simply asking that next year there should be 97. This is not a monumental difference. I think we could do it. So they would have to save energy, be more efficient, and there's 100 ways in which to do that. And then in addition to that, they would have to turn to renewables where they could, from wind and tide and solar energies, but above all to sort of change the way of life and the age of consumerism, and this whole financial system that is built around it would have to change and adapt. And I think that this protocol, if adopted, would give a little, take some of the tension out of what will otherwise be an awful shock to the system. So, and then the other nice feature about it is, whereas Kyoto requires all the nations, especially the main polluters, to agree in some manner, or at least buy their way out of it, which is a somewhat questionable approach, but anyway, this would not really require everybody to agree, because any country that adopted this principle would be effectively investing in its own future, and within a relatively short period of time, by virtue of having faced reality a little bit before they had to, would be better prepared, better organized, and indeed competitive with those who continue to live in the past. So this proposal seems to be gathering a certain momentum, and I think we're getting different countries to at least consider it and come on board. And I don't think it matters too much whether the thing is actually signed at the end of the day, so long as this debate now begins to filter into the people in control. I think one incidental effect upon this of this proposal is that one of the conditions of the importers would license the imports, so there would be a control on what was imported. There'd have to be to control the amount. And as a condition of granting this license, they would then require to know from which field the oil was coming. And secondly, they would exert the right, at least, to be able to go and audit the reserves of this field on the grounds that they have a right to know how much longer they can expect to receive oil from this source. And so in this way, this whole obscure situation of what the resource actually is would be resolved in order to calculate what the depletion rate would be. And I think that is an incidental benefit of this thing, to bring a certain clarity, because I should emphasize really that all these different viewpoints are made possible by the atrocious condition of the public data. If the real data was made available to everybody, the conclusions would be self-evident. There would be no need to discuss it at all. It would be so incredibly obvious. But all of these different factions are made possible by the extremely unreliable data, so that anybody can say more or less anything he wants.
What is the real significance of the recent Royal Dutch Shell reserve write-downs?
Yes, the Shell incident has really got quite interesting elements to it. And I think it really says a lot about many aspects of things. You see, Shell regarded itself as a very superior kind of company. It, you know, Shell was the cream of the cream, at least in their eyes. And I'm sure the situation arose that, as in all companies, always underreported what they'd found. This was the standard way in which all companies worked. And So you would have a financial group whose job it was to make the annual report for the company, and they would report as much reserves as they needed to report to deliver a satisfactory financial result. And so this has been going on for years, and it was entirely standard practice. And so if they needed a little bit more reserve somewhere for the annual report, well, the head office would call their man in Nigeria, say, well, we need a bit more this year. And in the past, there was no problem with doing this because there was a huge stock of underreported reserves that they knew existed everywhere in a sort of intangible, ill-defined way. They just always knew there was a bit more than they claimed. This was the traditional way the industry worked. And so, and Shell being Shell, it was one of the few major companies that didn't merge with anybody else, because with their sort of superbia mentality, why would they soil themselves by mixing themselves up with a lesser entity? Whereas BP and Texaco, Chevron and ExxonMobil, they all overcame this little difficulty that's been unfolding for them all by merging, and in the course of merging completely confused the reserves and the accounts and everything else. And in practice, the lesser of the partners to the merger was absorbed by the stronger party, who effectively bought the reserves of the lesser one. So all the other companies overcome this fact that they were running out of this stock of underreported reserves, but poor old Shell was still trying to do it in the ground, not on Wall Street. And so I suppose that over a period of time, another aspect of this is that Shell had a rather delegated structure, so that the man in Nigeria had quite a lot of autonomy over what he could do. So, you know, and they're all part of this group and club, and the affiliates sort of have their friends at head office, and they work together in that sort of club-like environment. But I suppose that over the years it began slowly to become evident that, well, Nigeria just didn't have any more on board, you know. And then I think the oil in the ground was probably secure enough. I'm sure the reserves, as estimated, were genuine technical reserves, but they probably weren't strictly commercial at that time. And, you know, in places like Nigeria, there must be many commercial obstacles, and contracts are insecure, and hopes are not always met, and that kind of thing. So that in a strict SEC meaning, they were sort of over-reporting what they had. And gradually they came to become aware of this, and then they tried to hope that it would somehow solve itself and say, let's put that off to next year, and perfectly reasonable reaction, actually. And slowly they found they couldn't put it off till next year, and then, of course, they started accusing each other of having failed, and the typical management behavior of always trying to find somebody to blame for something going wrong, and they started throwing mud at each other. And eventually, of course, the investment community, who really understands nothing about anything particular, went into a complete spasm over this adjustment, and it cost the poor old chairman his job. Failure in the south, found in about 78. So the bulk of Iraq's oil are in these three big ones, and then there are smaller ones in this prime trend. But there's a large shelf to the west, which is relatively unexplored, but it still does have quite a lot of wells on it, and it's quite evident that this is outside the main oil belt. So simply by looking at a large stretch of empty territory is not to assume that it's full of oil.
That was Dr. Colin Campbell speaking after the annual ASPO workshop 2004 in Berlin, interviewed by Julian Daly for Global Public Media on May 27, 2004.